obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Good evening. My name's Carl. I'm an alcoholic. I know. Down here in Orange County, you're saying, where on earth is Covina? I know. Anyway, I would like to thank Debbie for the privilege of being here today. And whoever, that basket, that is a great basket. My kids are going to be eating for a week off of that, I guarantee you. And I'd like to thank the rest of the committee, and I'd like to thank my friends Jackie and Kelly for figuring out how to get me a cup of coffee before the meeting, because if I would have been standing in that Starbucks line, I would still be there right now. Have you guys seen that line? Goodness sakes. Anyway, I'm an alcoholic. It's really the most important thing I can tell you about myself. My sobriety date is January 21st, 1987. I am 53 years old, so I've been sober and Alcoholics Anonymous more than half my life. And the fact that I'm an alcoholic is literally the most important thing that I can tell you about myself. There's a lot of things I could tell you about myself that I aspire to be, that I've tried to be, that I have accomplished, that I have failed miserably at. But the most important thing is that I'm an alcoholic. And the reason I believe I'm an alcoholic is really very simple. I've got a really strange relationship with alcohol. That's why I'm an alcoholic. It's not too complicated. And this strange relationship that I have with alcohol takes on a few forms. The first part of this strange relationship that I have with alcohol happens when I drink it. A very strange thing happens when I drink booze. The book calls it an allergic reaction. And the book says the symptom of this allergic reaction that I get when I drink booze is what they call the phenomenon of craving. And the best way that I can describe this thing that the book calls the phenomenon of craving in my life is that it seems like whenever I drink booze, the more booze I drink, the thirstier I get. It happens with nothing else, just alcohol. An example of that is, they're kind enough to give me a little bit of water to drink up here over the next 3 hours that I'm talking with you. And I will probably drink at least one of these cups of water, maybe another cup of water if my mouth gets dry. But I can absolutely swear to you that once I finish this water that they have up here tonight, there is no chance that I'm going to go get a case of water and lock myself in my hotel room. It's not going to happen. There is no chance that I, at 3 a.m., I'm going to get a hold, I'd be calling my friend Giuseppe here. Giuseppe, man, I need another case. I'll turn the pink slip in my car. Come on! Right? There's no chance of that happening. But if that was the only thing that made me alcoholic, just this physical reaction that I get, if that was the only thing that made me alcoholic, well then, Just Say No would have wiped out alcoholism, right? Early 80s, Nancy Reagan came out and said, Just Say No. I would have, and I imagine you would have gone, ha ha, no. And just gone on and lived a happy, successful life just saying no. But I've got this other strange part of my relationship with alcohol, and that happens when I'm not drinking it. Even by myself, if I don't drink for a day, a week, or a month, I seem to have this mind that is able to paint a picture that makes it okay to take another drink, no matter what the pain, humiliation, and suffering was a day, a week, or a month ago. And it seems to never enter into the equation whether it was my pain and humiliation or your pain and humiliation. Could care less. But sooner or later, my mind is able to rationalize and justify my walk back to the next drink at all costs. So I can't drink successfully because of this bizarre physical reaction that I get, but I cannot on my own not drink successfully. I'm damned if I do, and I'm damned if I don't. It's the ultimate catch-22 we call alcoholism. Because I swear to you, if I could do either one of those two things, I would. I can't. I'm going to harp on that physical feature a little bit more because it's really the one thing, bar none, we all have in common, because we have a lot of things that we don't have in common in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, we really, really are a wide cross-section of society. We're all here, every different race, creed, color, religion, good background, bad background, education, no education, great jobs, no job. I mean, we're all here. In fact, Alcoholics Anonymous is the only place where the bank president, the bank teller, and the bank robber are all right here in the same room, right? And they all have a very different perception of what just happened. So So our stories are different on that level because of our different backgrounds, but we also drink differently than each other. We really do. To illustrate that, let's say we cracked open these back doors. And right up the center aisle, we wheeled up this big, giant cart with all the kinds of booze we all like. If you're a top-shelf drinker, you know, we got it. We got some Remy Martin, some Cavassier, we got it. If you're a bottom-shelf drinker, we got that too. Mad Dog 2020, we got it all. All of it. And everything in between. And if all of us took a good 4 or 5 stiff drinks, real drinks, no umbrellas, no spritzers, good 4 or 5 stiff drinks, we would all be acting very, very differently. Over in this corner, we'd have the good time crowd. Ah, ha, ha, fa, ha, ta, woo, woo, party, 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 hey, off to the next bar, woo, right? Add a little methamphetamine, we talk a little faster, right? But we're having a good time in this corner. Over in this corner, we got the sobbers, woo. Over in this corner, we got the fighters, always getting into fights. Over here, a bunch of us would be naked. I personally would be going to each corner trying to get a couple of friends to come over here with me. So our stories are different on that level, too. Right over here in the good time crowd, they get a lot of DUIs, right? Always, hey, where's the next bar we're going to? Next party, who's going to after hours? Hey, somebody's got to stop at a liquor store, right? Always out there on the road, got to get to the next place, a lot of DUIs. Over in the sobbing corner, no DUIs. They don't even leave the damn house. Just, ah! Worst thing that they do is the late night drunk dialing. Or God forbid these days, the drunk Facebooking. Over in this corner, the fighting corner, always got probation, parole, jail time, right? Lawyers, court dates, you know, all that. Over in this corner, lots of children show up by surprise. Right, so our stories are different on that level, too. But there's one thing, bar none, no matter which corner we were in, that we would all be doing. We'd all be back at the cart for another drink. And that's what I really needed to learn when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous, as to what to listen to for identification. Because if I'm listening that way in Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't care who's up here. You alcoholic, I'm you, you're me. You can have every single other difference in the world, and I don't need to identify with that stuff. Right? But you know what? The longer we stay here, I find out I've got a lot more in common with you as a human being, too. And that's a real important aspect, too. But early on, when we're sitting there picking and nitpicking the differences, it's real important. It was really important for me to figure that out. So I set this relationship up that I just described to you very early on when I first started drinking. And I started drinking much later than a lot of people in AA. I was 11. It's late these days. These days, don't you guys hear it in your home groups? Goodness sakes, some guy 12 years old got a year already. 3 treatment centers. We lived in Seattle, and a typical morning for me in 7th grade would be I'd show up early for school, not for study hall or anything, but to meet my new friends at the very edge of the school property, Loser's Corner. Every school's got a Loser's Corner. It's 10 feet off the school property. You know, everybody's out there smoking and looking cool, and we would also have what I like to call the playground cocktail. That is a jar full of whatever we could rip off out of the parents' liquor cabinet the night before, and that jar is pretty scary because none of us have been to bartending school yet. Right, so there's, and plus you're in a hurry when you're ripping off the parents, right? You're just grabbing anything you'd see and pouring it into this jar, right? A mixture of whiskey, vodka, cream de menthe, vermouth, all in the same jar. You can imagine 6 or 7 of us, 11, 12-year-olds, handing that jar around, trying to choke that down. Of course, it was the early 70s, so we're smoking that commercial pot. Anybody remember that stuff? 4-finger lids, $10 a bag, seeds and stems and the whole bit. And it was even before Ziploc baggies were invented, when it would just be a regular Glad bag. And as you'd roll it up, there'd be like 9 people spit on it. Like, oh, man. You pack all those seeds and stems and leaves into a homemade pipe, maybe made out of plumbing fittings and a screen. Or if you're really desperate that morning, it would be a toilet paper roll with aluminum foil and pinholes in it. Were you guys there, too? Yeah. I know, some of these young kids are going, that sounds very different than the chronic I've been smoking. It was. Now, it's at this point that many people that speak in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, at this point that they often interrupt themselves and they say something like this. I don't mean to offend anybody, but drugs are a part of my story. I understand and I know what they're attempting to do there. They're attempting to protect singleness of purpose. Vitally important aspect of Alcoholics Anonymous should never be forgotten. Absolutely. But that idea aside, I still think it's a bizarre practice for alcoholics to apologize to other alcoholics for doing drugs while drinking or in between drunks. I understand apologizing to police officers and judges and people that may still love us, but I don't know why we apologize to each other, for God's sake. In fact, the most bizarre example of that I've ever seen, it was a number of years ago. I was having a big meeting out in the west side of Los Angeles, and that night the speaker was up there just giving one of the most nasty, heinous, blow-by-blow drunkologues I've ever heard. And I got to tell you, when I'm in the meeting listening to the speaker, when the drunkologue starts to get ugly, the uglier it gets, the more excited I get. And I think that night I was on the edge of my chair drooling, looking up at the guy going, "Yeah, buddy, go, 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 go." And at one point, this really ugly story, this guy said, "You know, I had 4 DUIs, and the judge said if I get one more DUI, I'm going to prison for sure." He says, 2 weeks later, after being in court, I'm on the freeway, I'm in a blackout, and I hit a family of 4. They all wound up in the hospital, I wound up in prison. In prison, I sodomized, man, I was sodomized, and I don't mean to offend anybody, but I did some drugs, too. Like, huh? I was the only one that thought that was strange that night. Everybody's, "Oh, yeah, you can mention it." So anyway, by the time I'm 14 there in Seattle, I'm the neighborhood drunk, I'm the neighborhood pot dealer, I forgot to mention, but my father was a neighborhood Lutheran minister. And he didn't find anything funny about this at all. My parents, really, really good people, and they knew something was wrong. They really did. It was obvious that something was wrong. By the time I'm 14, my hair is down onto my shoulders and in front of my bloodshot eyes, my vocabulary is, "Whoa. Whoa," right? That's my vocabulary. But my parents blame my problems on people, places, and things. You see, they didn't understand I was alcoholic. They blame my problems on people, places, and things. They thought, if we can get him away from that group of kids he's hanging out with, things would get better. If we can get him out of that damn public school system, things would get better. They tried all of the above, but you see, I'm an alcoholic. My problems are not based upon people, place, and things. My problems are based upon my physical and mental relationship to alcohol. See, if you change the people, place, and things in somebody's life like mine, all that happens is that I'm loaded with different people in different places, ruining different things. That's all that happens. So by the time I'm about 18, I barely scraped out of the public school system there in Seattle after getting kicked out of the private school system. And my parents decided that Seattle was a problem. If you can get them out of Seattle, things would get better. So they sent me 300 miles away to Washington State University. I spent 3 years at that university on my parents' money, and I got almost 10 credits. At any given time, my grade point average matched my blood alcohol content about a 0.25. Did nothing at that school. By the time I was 22, this little story I'm about to tell you will let you know exactly where I stood with my family. Now, my father was Swedish, my mother is Icelandic, therefore I look like a polar bear. And I don't know whether this custom I'm about to tell you about is Scandinavian or whether it's Lutheran. I don't know. But at Christmas time, my parents wouldn't just send out Christmas cards to their friends and relatives. My parents would send out this big, long Christmas letter that said everything the family had been doing that year. And when I was about 22, I got a hold of one of these letters that had been sent out the previous Christmas, and as I read it, it let me know exactly where I stood with my family. Now, the first paragraph talked about what my parents had been doing that year, another impressive year, I'm sure. The next paragraph talked about what the Morris children had been doing that year, and that paragraph went something like this. "Our oldest daughter, Christina, just graduated from Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, with a master's degree in human resources. She's now working for a large pharmaceutical company in the Midwest. She traveled to Europe this summer. She saw this, she saw that. Her hobbies are this, this, and this. She's a very happy young woman. We are very proud of her. Our oldest son, Eric, just graduated from Western Washington State University with a degree in marketing. He's now working for a large advertising firm here in downtown Seattle. He loves the golf. He loves to travel. He's engaged to be married to this wonderful woman named Mary Lou, who works for a very small company here in Seattle named Microsoft." It was small at one time, and they love to golf together, they love to travel together. He's a very happy young man. We are very proud of him. Our youngest son, Carl, just turned 22. They were actually being very kind. Long story short, it really would take till breakfast to describe everything involved in what I'm going to... I'm not going to... Really, it would just take too long to describe what happened here, so I just cut right to the chase, and a really bad night happened, so I joined the Navy. It was that bad of a night. What I'm about to tell you should scare the living daylights out if you care anything about the security of the United States, but on my way into the Navy, I passed a potential test. It's called the ASVAB test, and this should concern you. I took this test, and it qualified me to become a nuclear engineer. That should concern you that the United States Navy would have any type of system in place that would maybe, possibly, or even remotely allow somebody like me near anything nuclear. However, they made me take another test when I showed up at that base for boot camp, and I could not pass that particular test. This test is called a urinalysis test, is what it's called. Never knew how to pass those. God, I still remember, I can picture it like it was yesterday. I'd been in boot camp for about 7 or 8 days, and in came the master at arms, and that's military police, and he had this clipboard with about 5 or 6 names on it, and I knew my name was going to be on that clipboard. I knew. And the 5 or 6 of us were taken out of the barracks and taken over to the other side of the Great Lakes Naval Base, from the training side to the administrative side, and the other 4 or 5 guys were taken into one building. Now it's taken into a completely separate building, right into the commanding officer's office, the guy who ran the whole Great Lakes Naval Base. Beautiful office, plush carpeting, big oak desk, pictures of naval vessels up on the wall, and I'm standing there, and he asks me my name, and I give him my name, and this would have been the early 80s, so on this big oak desk, he had a telephone with a speakerphone attachment to it, and he pushed a button on the speakerphone attachment, and into that speakerphone, he said, "Walt, that's my father's name." At this point, I guess this would have been 1984, my father would have been in the United States Navy, both active and reserve, for over 40 years at that point. He had been active in 2 different wars, and this was an old World War II buddy of my father's. Now, you can imagine my surprise. I was like... And into this phone, this man said, "Walt, out of consideration for our long-term friendship, I thought maybe I should call you before I took any action. I'm supposed to kick your son out right now. What do you think we ought to do?" Now, normally, if you met my father, you would have noticed a couple of things. He loved life. He viewed it as a huge privilege, and you could sense that from his voice and his body language, that he loved life, and he spoke with a passion and a determination in life that you could sense right away upon meeting him. There was another voice that would come out of that man. And it was a voice like somebody had just kicked him right below the belt. It was defeated, confused, and weak. And I'd heard that voice out of my father many, many times in the previous 10 years, and it was usually when he was dealing with me. And that's the voice that came through that little speakerphone that morning, and I heard my father's destroyed voice just say, "It's just none of my concern anymore." And then I heard what I can still hear today, click and dial tone. And I remember looking up, and that guy looked at me from across the desk, and he just kind of shook his head. This man decided to keep me in the Navy anyway. But he took away that nuclear status thing. Thank God for you guys. He goes, "We ain't letting you near any of that." A year and a half later, I'm a lower rank than when I first came in. It's kind of like this, you know, I knew I was in the Navy. It was obvious. All I had to do was survey my surroundings on any given day. I'd look around, by God, I'm in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. I am on a big gray ship. I am in a uniform. There is no doubt about it. I am in the United States Navy. However, that ship would pull into a port, and I would leave that ship, and I'd take a drink. And I would totally forget that I'm in the United States Navy. There's something else going on at this point in my life. I'm 23, 24, 25 years old at this point. And at this point in my life, when I take a drink, I have no idea whether it's going to be 3 hours or 3 days. I don't know how long that drunk's going to last. And I got to tell you, coming out of one of those 3-day drunks, it's a very strange feeling coming out of one of those 3-day drunks, and I realize it's early in the morning, and I'm in a foreign country. And I'm on a large pier, and I start looking... There was a destroyer here the other day. I'd been in the Navy almost 2 years, and I was coming out of one of those, another one of those three-day drunks, and I'd been in downtown San Diego, and my car was held together by rubber bands, and I was late getting back to the ship, and this was nothing new, and I was racing back to get to the ship, and I was doing what I was always doing. I would always save a pint to come out of one of those three-day drunks. I would drink half that pint on my way back to the ship. I'd keep the other half a pint underneath my seat so at noontime I can run off the ship and go drink the other half a pint. It's kind of my way of sliding into Tuesday. This particular morning, I was paying more attention to getting that half a pint in me than where the car was going. And at the front of every Navy base, this is, of course, pre-9/11, at the front of every Naval base, there's a guard check where a Marine stands duty. And under normal circumstances, you're supposed to slowly and politely pull your car up to the guard check and show them your military ID. He'll check the sticker on your car. If everything's in order, he'll allow you to proceed onto the base. This particular morning, I was paying more attention to getting that half a pint in me than where the car was going, and all of a sudden, my eyes came into focus, and I saw the Marine had his head out of the guard check. And I was wondering what he was so excited about until I looked down and realized I was still going 40 miles an hour. I yanked the wheel, and the car hit this median on the right-hand side and flipped over and bang, right through that guard check. I can still see that Marine doing this big dive out of there. Thank God those guys are in good shape. He did a quick somersault, and he's right back up, weapon drawn. Right? He was ready. He was all right, as I said, but they were patching me up at the hospital for minor injuries, and they were reading new charges on me. And this is nothing significant in my life. New charges, that's just what happens in a guy's life like mine about every 90 days if you're living the way I'm living. So there's nothing significant about new charges, but the most significant thing that the Navy doctors did that morning is they prescribed this stuff called Anabuse for me. Oh, I heard here. Oh, yes, there's some Anabuse takers in here. They prescribed this stuff called Anabuse, and I was now under orders to show up at sick bay every single morning before quarters, and they would put this little white pill on my tongue and make me sit there for a half an hour to make sure it actually ingested in my system. Over the next 7 to 10 days, I started to experience the most cunning, baffling, and powerful side of this thing we call alcoholism. That is, I had no alcohol or drugs in my system, and I was literally, slowly going insane. See, when you take alcohol away from me, and you do not specifically give me the center of Alcoholics Anonymous, something very strange happens to me. I literally feel boxed in. I have a hard time breathing. Best way I've ever heard it described is that I feel like a scream looking for a mouth. And I can't tell you what it is that's going on because you're angry at me about my last drunk. And you're pointing out, you know, all the things that are wrong. And I agree with you. I agree. Yes, the price is getting high. Yes, I am not happy about the car being on fire either. I'm with you on this one. I agree. But if I had the ability to describe to the people that were angry at me and taking alcohol away from me and pointing the fingers, I would say something like this, but I didn't have the vocabulary. I would say, but if you knew how I felt when I wasn't drinking, you wouldn't be asking me why I drink. And I didn't know how to explain that to anybody. And now they've put me on this Anabuse. And I remember counting the days, just it's been 4 days. And I'm on Anabuse. Now it's been 6 days, and I'm on Anabuse. Now it's been 8 days, 6 hours, and 15 minutes, and I'm on Anabuse. And I started to look around that ship. The other men, they're talking behind my back. All 300 of them. Have you ever felt that way in AA? The only difference is that in AA, we are talking behind your back. It's not an illusion. We're really doing it. Only with love and tolerance in Orange County, I'm sure. On the 10th day, I just snapped and I went AWOL from my ship. I locked myself in this little hotel room in downtown San Diego, Plaza Hotel. It's on 4th and Broadway. It's still there. This would have been mid-1986. And in mid-1986, the Plaza Hotel was $13 a night. They've upgraded that part of downtown San Diego since then. And they kind of bypassed the Plaza Hotel. It's now $19 a night. Anyway, I remember sitting in this little room at the Plaza Hotel, and there I had a bottle of vodka, on this rickety little end table, and I remember sitting on the edge of the bed looking at this bottle of vodka, and as I stared at the bottle of vodka, I remembered that the Navy doctors had given me a very stern warning about drinking on top of Anabuse when they'd prescribed it for me. They said, son, you need to understand that if you drink on top of this Anabuse, you will get one of two reactions. One reaction is you will get violently ill. The other reaction is you might die. I remember looking at the bottle, and I thought, well, wonder which reaction I'm going to get. So I took one shot and nothing happened. Authority had lied to me again as far as I was concerned. I waited about 2 minutes just to make sure, and I took another shot. All of a sudden I felt tingly in the face, so I looked in this cracked little mirror that was in this hotel room, and I was bright red, blotchy and purple in places. Took another shot. All of a sudden I could feel my heart going boom, boom, boom. Looked at my shirt, I was drenched in sweat, and all of a sudden I was like... hyperventilating. We're doing all right so far. You guys are pretty sick if you think this is funny. I actually have proof. You all look very, very nice tonight, but apparently you're not well. I got proof. I'm gonna skip ahead a couple of years. I'm going to come back to this hotel room. Very important stuff happening in this hotel room. But I'm going to skip ahead a couple of years. 2 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got an honorable discharge out of the Navy. And my first sponsor and his sponsor were real sticklers about that ninth step. And one of the things that I was unable to do with step nine while I was still in the Navy, because they had set out this payment plan with my Navy paycheck. It was just ridiculous. That's what I got about 8% of my paycheck because it just assigned to go other places just to get me fairly close to even with society before I got out of the Navy. But one of the things I couldn't accomplish was that my parents had paid for a bachelor's degree. I did not have one. I was given two choices. I either had to pay them back every single nickel they had wasted on that, or I had to go get what they had paid for in the first place. So when I got out of the Navy, I used some VA benefits, and I signed up to go to get this business telecommunications bachelor's degree. And in the first couple of semesters, I had to take this business presentation class. It's kind of like a speech class for, you guessed it, giving business presentations. And in the first couple of days of the speech class, the instructor was randomly pointing at students one at a time, throwing them up in front of the room, giving them a topic to talk on, and each student was supposed to talk for, I don't know, 90 seconds, a couple of minutes on whatever the instructor said. And after about seven or eight students were thrown up there, he pointed at me, and I walked up to the front of the room, and from the back of the room, the instructor shouted out, "Talk about a bizarre situation in your life." So I told them about drinking on top of Anabuse. They did not respond the way you guys responded. They were like... There were, though, a couple of guys in the back going, "Woohoo! Right on, dude! Woo!" So anyway, I'm back in the hotel room. I'm red-faced. I'm hyperventilating and sweating. And I took another shot. And up it came. My... second sponsor was a man named Eddie Cochran, literally one of the pioneers of Southern California Alcoholics Anonymous. He died in 1999 with 47 years of sobriety. This year, he would have been going on 63 years of sobriety had he lived.
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
He called the next thing that happened to me projectile regurgitation. This is a new level of puking I'm unfamiliar with, right? We all know normal puking, right? You get a little sour taste in the back of your throat. You kind of go, and we know we're supposed to look for a bathroom if there happens to be one. If we're driving, we try to get the window down because based upon our experience, that really does ruin the night. It's all over your car, right? Or if it's your friend's shoe that night, that's just the way it goes. But we get the warning. But here on the Anabuse, no warning. It's just, sort of this Linda Blair spray across the room. Thank God the Plaza Hotel is the type of hotel room where the toilet is in the same room with the bed. It's a design feature, I believe. Maybe to make convicts feel more at home upon release. I'm not really sure. But I found the magic of drinking on top of Anabuse that if you hang in there, and it's really important, if you're going to drink on top of Anabuse, you got to do two things to be successful. The first thing is you got to hang in there. You cannot half measure this. You can't just go, oh, I don't like that. You got to hang in there, right? And at the very same time, if you're going to be successful at this, other than hanging in there, you got to not die. So if you can put those two things together, have at it. I found the magic of Anabuse that if I kept drinking and kept puking and kept drinking and kept puking for about an hour and a half, enough of the Anabuse would kick out of my system and I would quit throwing up. And I would just be left with red-faced, hyperventilating and sweating, and I'm pretty much all right with that. So I drank on top of Anabuse the last 7 months of my drinking. There's no other way to describe this other than desperation drinking. My second to my last drunk, I was left for dead in a pool of blood in a motel parking lot in National City. They had to do reconstructive surgery on my face that morning. My last night of drinking, I was being brought out of the San Diego jail. I was in handcuffs, and I was with civilian authorities, and they were trying to get me back to military authorities. And it was one of those mornings where the handcuffs were extra tight, and the people around me in uniforms were extra angry. You know, those, and the neck muscles weren't working too well. Kind of like that. And I remember that morning when they finally got me back to the quarterdeck of our ship, the officer deck put his arm up and said, wrong answer. Orders have already been processed on this loser. The orders are 90 days in the brig, bad conduct discharge, or treatment. Now, as I stood there in those handcuffs, apparently some sort of option was thrown out on the table. Now, I don't remember thinking, oh, God, you're so good to a bum like me. I just can't keep going like this. I don't remember that. Nor do I remember, and it would have been more likely, but I don't remember this either, that I would have thought, hey, if I just act like I want that treatment thing, maybe I can get out of this one too. I don't remember that either. But I now know that it wouldn't have mattered what I was thinking or feeling that morning because I was in handcuffs. And I don't know about your experience in handcuffs, but my experience with handcuffs was always the same. Throughout my life, whenever I was in handcuffs, whoever had me in handcuffs, never once did they ever say, so what's your opinion on this matter? Right? When you're in handcuffs, you go where they say. And they took me up to this military treatment center up in the north end of San Diego at the Miramar Naval Air Station. And when the doors were locked behind me, that's when they took the handcuffs off me. And that is what the society in which I live feels about how Carl Morris acts out there in the world without Alcoholics Anonymous, and rightfully so. So I'm in this treatment center, and the first couple of days they're doing medical checkups. They're trying to figure out, there's about 35 men and women that we're all going to do this 45 days together. And they're doing medical checkups on us. They're trying to, contact our ship, base, or command to get our files sent over. And they're doing this group therapy thing. And so we're all kind of sitting in this group in the first couple of days. And, you know, some are off at medical checkups. Others are being interviewed to get their files. But they've got us in this group. And they got this assistant facilitator trying to get us to talk. And none of us are talking. We're our arms folded, looking down at the ground, not saying a word. And he's getting more frustrated by the hour as it goes in, and he's giving us his best. He's telling us, you know, he's got this whiteboard up there and drawing this and drawing charts, but none of us are talking. And somewhere between the second and third day, finally, this one guy finally says something and raises his hand and says, I'd like to say something. This guy's name was Paco. He's from some other base somewhere, and he raises his hand, and the instructor goes, yes, Paco, what would you like to say? And Paco said, I hear that I'm supposed to be rigorously honest with you guys if I'm going to do this staying sober thing. And I want you guys to know that Paco's not my real name. Paco's just a name I've always used since I've been a young teenager, and I've always used it when things look like trouble. And the other day when I got here, this looked like trouble. But you're going to find out anyway when my file gets here, but I want to be honest and upfront before my file gets here. And I want you guys to know that my real name is Randy. Will you guys call me Randy from now on? So the rest of us kind of go, okay, whatever, Randy, nice to meet you. But this assistant facilitator got really excited and said, oh, my God, this is the first breakthrough of any honesty of any of you SOBs. Later that afternoon, they called us all together again, and they called Randy up from the back, and he walked all the way to the front. They had a gold name tag that they'd made during the day that said Randy. They slapped it on his chest, and they said, whenever staff's not around, Randy's in charge. And Randy stood there, I guess you get promoted pretty quick in this treatment thing. And Randy loved his new job, and we all hated Randy. On the seventh day in this place, they took us all to our first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. At least it was my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all I know, we'd been in this place for 7 days. And over the 1MC, it's like an intercom system through the barracks. They said, civilian closed, parking lot, 6 p.m. So we're all out there in civilian clothes. About five white vans pulled up, and they, again, the clipboard thing, they started naming, you know, five or six guys, men and women, into each van, and boom, out each van took off to a different meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous somewhere in San Diego County. And if you've ever been to meetings in San Diego, you see us, the military, we sit right in the back. And the van I was in, sure enough, pulled up at one of your meetings, and I sat in the back, and you guys just carried on with your meeting. You didn't care. You didn't go, do you really qualify to be here? You didn't, you know, harass. I'm so grateful that you guys just continue on with your meetings and let the military sit right there in the back. Don't make us qualify or anything, and that you just carry on whether we're there or not. It's beautiful, absolutely beautiful. And most of the guys, I guarantee it, you know, we don't want to be there. But something was happening to me, because I think that that particular meeting that night was a responsible meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they were taking care of that podium that night, because I was sitting there identifying. About 15 people came up. Here's podium participation, and the first few read some stuff, and I was just like, whoa. And the next 10 or 12 people got up and just talked for 2 to 3 minutes each. And almost every single one of them I identified with, and there was two things that I was identifying with. Number one, the way they were describing their drinking. I'd heard drinking stories before. I had told drinking stories before. I had lived drinking stories. But there was something about the way you guys told your drinking story that was different. Without even saying it, I knew you were free of it. It's strange. Then there was something else that really floored me. The way you guys described the way you felt when you were not drinking. Because I had never heard that. And I could never have described it. I didn't have any words for it. And you guys had a whole language behind it. I mean, you just had words all over the place. Restless, irritable, and discontent, spiritual malady, you know, feeling completely separate from you. Don't know how to function on this planet. You guys were just using that like off the cuff, like it was yesterday's news. Right? And I was like, whoa! I'll never forget this one guy got called and he went all the way to the front. And to this day, 28 years later, I've never heard the alcoholic mind described better. Walked all the way to the front. He said, my mind would have killed my body a long time ago, but it needed it for transportation. And he walked around. So the next night, they took us to another meeting. And as much as I identified at that first meeting, I got equally confused at the next meeting. Because everybody at this meeting was talking about something called a drug of choice. You don't hear it that often anymore, but back in the 80s, man, you just heard it all the time. My drug of choice is. And well, my drug of choice is. And I'm sitting in the back going, oh, for God's sake, was I supposed to be choosing out there? Do they want me to choose now? What are they talking about? So the next morning, I'm back at the treatment center. I asked the counselor who had been assigned to us. Her name was Mary. I go, Mary, last night in the meeting, they're talking about something called a drug of choice. What do they mean by that? And she said, Carl, let's play a game. And that kind of worried me because I knew what she was saying. She was saying, Carl, pay attention. And that was difficult. I didn't know why it was difficult, but I now know why it was difficult to pay attention there in the first couple of days. Because, see, what had happened when I first arrived there, they did a medical checkup on me, and they found that my liver was extended, my pancreas was shutting down at extreme, what they call alcoholic edema. Apparently, drinking on top of Anabuse for 7 months does a little number on your internal organs. So they had salted my tail with those detox meds so that I don't throw the floppy fish, you know, and destroy everybody's day, and it can, you know, it distracts from the counseling when somebody's, right, choking. So they salt your tail with these detox meds. If you've ever been on them, you know what I'm talking about. Your field of vision is fine, just about right here. But there's dancing squiggly things over here. And when you turn to see what it is, now it's over here. And so you're doing a lot of... So when she said, Carl, let's play a game, I went, okay. She said, imagine this, Carl. We'll figure out what your drug of choice is, Carl. Imagine this. I walked into the room, she said, and I had a tray. And on that tray, I had a bottle of Jack Daniels, an ounce of cocaine, and an ounce of Thai sticks. Which one would you take? I started to drool immediately. Just, oh, I take them all. And she started to snap her fingers. Settle down, Carl. Settle down. Come back in the room, Carl. Play the game. You can't have them all. You can only have one. Which one would you take? I thought for a second. I said, well, if I can only have one, Mary, I guess I'd take the ounce of cocaine. She said, ah, maybe cocaine is your drug of choice. Do you understand now? And I said, no. She said, what's the problem? I said, well, Mary, the only reason I take the ounce of cocaine over the other two is, well, I take that ounce of cocaine, I get the hell out of here, and I'd sell 2 8-balls. I would now have enough money for a quarter pound of tie sticks and a case of Jack Daniels is what I would do. Now, the only reason I bring that up is to bring up a very important aspect of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's sobriety dates. If you're new or fairly new, you need to know that no matter what you think your drug of choice is, there's only one sobriety date. It's true. It's true. It doesn't matter what the guy outside the NA meeting said. There's only one sobriety date. If you work with a lot of people, maybe you run across this scenario every once in a while like I do. It's not very often, but every once in a while. But I like to, you know, say hi to new guys. Hey, good to see you. How long do you got? And every once in a while, not very often, but every once in a while, I get this kind of response. My drinking sobriety date is January 4th. My pot clean date is May 3rd. Oh, I blew my methamphetamine date last night. I was in Walmart all night long. It's like, no. Funniest thing I ever heard about sobriety date, same scenario. I saw this guy around my home group for a while. Hey, good to see you. How long do you got? And he said, well, I had 90 days, but I drank last night, so now I have 89 days. I almost had to call my sponsor. I think that kind of falls into the same category as being down in Mexico looking at the tequila going, would that affect my U.S. sobriety date? Yes. Yes, sobriety dates are international. Just a little information for the new guy, that's all. So anyway, after 45 days and let us all out of this place, just what the orders were, and they were going to let us out on a Friday afternoon. And on the Wednesday before that Friday, they gathered all 35 of us up. They put us in this room, and we're all kind of looking at each other. And then the side door opens up. The biggest, meanest counselor in the place comes in, and he's a Marine. That day, he's in his full dress uniform. I got to tell you, a Marine in his full dress uniform is a very impressive, very intimidating sight. And when we opened up the door and saw him in that dress uniform, we're like, just went dead silent. And we watched him walk across, and he walked across, came up to the podium, grabbed both sides of this podium in front and leaned over and stared at us. Didn't even speak for what seemed like forever. It was probably 10 seconds. But he panned the room and he said, you 35 have been through one of the finest treatment centers in the world for alcoholism and drug addiction. This treatment center has been here for many, many years. And over the years, our statistics have shown us that out of you 35, only one of you will stay continuously sober from this day forward. Many of you will die, go insane, wind up in prison. Nice little exit pep talk, don't you think? Goodness sakes. Then he said, many of you relapse once, twice, maybe 20 times, and make it back into long-term sobriety, but according to this treatment center statistics, only one of you will stay continuously sober from this day forward. Man, if you thought it was quiet before he said that, you could have heard a pin drop in the room now. The only thing you could hear was me going, shit. Because I knew if only one of us was going to make it, it was not going to be me. We all knew who it was going to be. It's going to be Randy over here, guaranteed. He's like the poster boy of the treatment center by now. So on this Friday afternoon, they're letting people out, and people are getting sent back to their ship's base and commands in various different ways, but there was about 4 or 5 of us that had been arrested in vehicles the night before we were thrown into this place. So we were informed that we needed to stand on the front door of the treatment center, and our cars would be brought out of this impound lot where they'd been for the last 45 days. So I'm standing there with a couple of guys. We're kind of looking at each other, and you feel treated? I don't know. You feel treated? What does that feel like? And all of a sudden, one of the guys I'm standing with points to this car that's coming across the parking lot and goes, is that Randy? And we go, sure enough. And then one of the other guys, he's drinking already. Sure enough, Randy's got a bottle. He's polishing it off. He rolls right in front of us. He rolls down the window. He throws the empty right at our feet. Crash! We look up. He gives us all the finger, and he drives right off. I guess his name was Paco again. I don't know. Next thing that I remember that day, I showed up in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. 6 o'clock gong show meeting in Pacific Beach. And I'm sitting in the back, and the truth about my life is I'm 45 days without a drink. I got a lot of information. And I'm physically feeling better than I have felt since I've been a young teenager. But there had been no spiritual awakening, spiritual experience, or even a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism. It was even more dangerous than that is that I did not know I needed one. One guy that night operated in his primary purpose, found me sitting in the back, came up to me and said, "Hey, never seen you here before. What are you doing?" I didn't think quick enough to lie to him, because I promise you, if I would have thought for one more second, I would have lied to him. And I accidentally told him the truth. And I said, "I don't know. I just got out of a Navy treatment center a couple hours ago. I don't know what I'm doing." This guy's eyes went bing, big smile went across his face. At the break, he's like fighting his friends off. He's mine, I got him, mine, mine. I didn't know you marked your newcomers around here. This was a Friday night, and this guy was really, really happy to meet me for a couple of reasons. Number one, he's just a solid member of Alcoholics Anonymous, loved to work with new people. But there was something else going on in this guy's life that made him especially glad to meet me that night. This guy's girlfriend had left him the night before for one of his friends in his home group. Yeah, so he's wondering what he was going to do with his weekend, homicide, suicide, get loaded, or grab this newcomer. He's like all over me all weekend. We went to like 18 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this guy was insane over this woman in between. Man, just in between this barrage of meetings, he'd throw him in the passenger side of his car, he'd start driving, and he'd start yelling. He wouldn't even look at the road. He had like one of those AA radar cars that just made it to the next meeting, I guess. And he'd be driving and yelling, "You gotta go to meetings, gotta read the book, you gotta get a sponsor. Damn her! Gotta go to meetings, gotta read the book." I'm like, Jesus. Now, I didn't know it, but I was getting a very early introduction to your typical AA relationship breakup is what I was getting. But I'm so very glad that that guy, that night, in his pain, was a guy in Alcoholics Anonymous who had done the work of Alcoholics Anonymous, had taken the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and therefore understood that the solution to his pain was out of self, out of self, out of self. Right? I'm so glad that he understood that there was not going to be any magical answer from a sponsor. There was going to be nobody to relieve that pain instantaneously. He had to absolutely focus in on what I was doing. And he was doing that not because he thought I might stay sober. It's that beautiful concept of that he was not dragging me around because I was alcoholic. He was dragging me around because he was alcoholic. And he was trying not to do something really stupid that weekend. I was just sort of a prop in his weekend. I'm glad I could be of service to him, right? After that weekend, I got back to my ship, and the one other sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous on my ship was waiting for me. His name was Bob W. He became my first sponsor. Before I even asked him, he just started doing the things that a sponsor would do, and he kind of had a captive audience. I would have had to jump overboard to get away from him. But he only had 14 months ahead of me. He was a perfect sponsor. My first 6 months of sobriety were meeting, coffee, 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 meeting, coffee, 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 meet a girl, meeting, coffee, 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 meeting. And I'd be running from meeting to meeting to meeting, desperately hoping that you would say something funny, clever, insightful, because I knew I would get this feeling of, okay, I'm all right. No, I'm not. Meeting, coffee, meeting. God, I still remember. There'd be nights when I'd be holding my gut after being at 4 or 5 meetings, if the ship were in port, because I just lived as a nomad my first couple of years of sobriety. Out at sea, back in, and just hit as many meetings as I could. But there'd be nights that I'd be holding my gut. What's wrong with me? God, what's wrong with me? Man, I remember this one night. I was literally thinking of committing suicide. You guys know that feeling? And I remember thinking, if this is what sobriety is, I don't know how much longer I can last. God, what's wrong with me? I remember there was still like a candlelight meeting I could still go to, so I left this motel room that I had gotten to get off the ship, because I got to tell you, it's tough being on a Navy ship with 60 men and it's almost like the size of a jail cell. And I went to this candlelight meeting, and this one old-timer shared that night. And he said, and I'm sitting there holding my gut like that. And he said, "If there's anybody in here that's thinking of committing suicide, I want you to know that I've got it on good authority." And when an old-timer says he's got it on good authority, we know what that means, directly from God. So it says, "I've got it on good authority that however you're feeling when you commit suicide is how you will feel for all of eternity." Like, Oh, this is bad news. This is really bad news. But he was a responsible member of Alcoholics Anonymous, never threw a problem out on the floor without already having the solution. So he said, so the trick is, wait till you're having a really good day, then do it. And I remember from the depths of my soul, I went from pure desperation to, ha, 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 right? And I caught one of the pieces of magic of Alcoholics Anonymous, where in an instant, because I came to you, my feet came to you, I identified, and something happened to my soul that day, and I said, ah, we laugh our way out of hell around here, don't we? Yes, we do. Ship had to go out to sea for an extended period of time, and my first sponsor, Bob W., said, when we're out at sea this time, every night at 6 p.m., meet me in the bottom of the engine room in the little battery shop, and don't you be late. And so I show up that first, when we're out at sea, I show up, and he walks in, he's got that blue book with him, and he tossed it down on the table. He says, I've been hounding about it for months. Have you read it? And I said something like, well, yeah. There's like how it works. We antagonists, some doctor with some opinion about something. And what he did next, I look back at it as Alcoholics Anonymous in its purest form. Remember, he was 14 months ahead of me. He was no expert. He just opened up the book and started to read. When he was tired, I would read. And he would share what little he knew, right, that his sponsor had probably taught him last week. And he was trying to share it with me. And there were two men down in the bottom of the engine room of the USS Cushing in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, two men with a big book, trying to have an experience, and neither one of us knew what that experience was. It's literally the blind leading the blind, Alcoholics Anonymous in its purest form. And it happened. It happened. What happened to me over the next 3 weeks and going through that book with him every night is that it's described in the back of the book as a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism. I took enough of the actions that the book asked us to do, where I was put in a position to then receive the gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I'm convinced that the real gift of Alcoholics Anonymous is not that I work the steps, it's when I ever so feebly try to help somebody else do what was done for me. That's where the real deal of Alcoholics Anonymous is. It's like the quantum leap of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't even think Alcoholics Anonymous has transpired between me and another guy until, and you know these phone calls, hey sponsor, I've got this problem, and this problem, and the third problem, it's got subset A, B, and C. What do I do? I'm confused. When the phone calls change from that to, hey sponsor, met this new guy, and he's got this problem, and this problem, and I just wanted to run it by you before I gave him any advice because I don't know what to do. Bingo, Alcoholics Anonymous has now transpired between me and him. I also learned right about this time that there's this magic that happens here in Alcoholics Anonymous that happens nowhere else. It's the thread that binds us and separates us from the rest of everything else that tries to help the world. And that is this idea of one alcoholic sharing with another, that this magic happens that happens nowhere else. And I'll never forget how I learned it. As I said, I would often try to get off the ship whenever we pull into port. My first sponsor, Bob W., would also do that. We'd often split a hotel room. This particular time, we're in Victoria, British Columbia. And we got a hotel room, and then we went out to the AA clubhouse. And after the meeting, Bob said, you know, I'm not really feeling very well. I'm heading back to the hotel room. I'll see you later, Carl. And I stayed out and maybe went to another meeting, went out to eat with the guys from AA there. I don't remember. But came to the hotel room about an hour and a half later. And Bob, on his way back to the hotel room, had found this guy from our ship named Blair. And Blair was hammered. And Blair had vomit down him and, you know, crap all over him. And Bob had him on my bed. And he had him up against the headboard, propped up there with a pillow and a chair and an end table. And Blair's on my bed. And Bob is on the other bed reading the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous to him. Now I look at this, and Blair doesn't even know where he's at. He's like, oh. So I think this is ridiculous, right? Bob's sitting there. We are more than 100 men and women who are seemingly over there. And I'm thinking, this is ridiculous. Blair doesn't even know where he's at. I don't know. I threw my 10 cents in, and after a little bit, we carried Blair back to our ship to make sure he got into his rack safely, and that's the last we heard of Blair for weeks. Now we're back in port, back in San Diego, a number of weeks later, and I'm in my rack. 3 a.m. in the morning, all of a sudden on the side of my rack, wake up, and I'm like, whoa, and it's Bob. And he whips back the curtain, he goes, Carl, wake up, Blair's on the Coronado Bridge. I'm like, whoa. Apparently over the last few weeks, Blair has tried to drink, he's tried not to drink, he's tried to drink, he's tried not to drink. Now he's at the jumping off place. He's on the Coronado Bridge. Now, I don't know if you know about the Coronado Bridge, but it used to be, it probably still is, a very popular suicide spot. Such a popular suicide spot back in the 80s and 90s, they had suicide hotline phones up at the top, just in case you change your mind. They're hoping your feet are still on the bridge when you do change your mind. And Blair had apparently picked up one of those suicide hotline phones. And he was talking to a very well-meaning, highly qualified suicide hotline counselor. And this is apparently what Blair was saying to her. I will only talk to Bob W. She was saying, who's Bob W? Blair was saying, it's anonymous. So she goes to get her boss, right, supervisor, another well-meaning, highly qualified suicide hotline counselor, and they both get on the line. They start doing the good cop, bad cop, firing questions to confuse them and trip them up. And they found out he's from the Navy and what ship he's from. So they took a shot in the dark, calling down to the quarterdeck of our ship, and the guy answered the phone at 3 a.m. They go, we know this is a real long shot, but is there a Bob W. on that ship? Now, my first sponsor, Bob, he'd guard your anonymity at the level of that ship, but he did not guard his own so he could be of service at any time. So the guy who answered said, yeah, Mr. 12 Steps, we know all about him. So they go down and get Bob, and Bob comes and gets me. Wake up. So he goes, come on. And we get into Bob's car. We start driving down to the base of the Coronado Bridge, and as we're driving, Bob looks over at me and says, Carl, get the big book out of the glove box. Bone up on working with others. Like, all right. And he sees me confused. He goes, oh, forget it. We're going to wing it tonight. We get down to the base of the Coronado Bridge, and everything that San Diego County has available for a situation like this is there. The paramedics are there. The fire department is there. The police department. The on-duty psychologist is there. We start walking up on this scene. The fireman, who seems to be in charge, goes, is one of you Bob W.? And Bob goes, yeah, that's me. He goes, I don't know what you're going to do. We've been talking to him for over an hour, and he ain't budging, but here, give it a shot. Hands him his little speakerphone contraption, and Bob goes, Blair? And you can hear on the other end, Bob, is that you? And Bob goes, yes, Blair, it's me, and I'll get the hell down from that bridge. And you hear, okay. One alcoholic can affect another alcoholic like no one else can. Don't forget that. Nobody can help us but us. We have a responsibility to show up and take our seats in our home group. We really, really do. I know after years you start going, really, is this all there is? Right? Anyway, 2 years sober after I got out of the Navy, I told you, got an honorable discharge. That was the result of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, an apparently merciful God, and a personnelman that lost half my file. That's how that happened. And I told you I was going to go to school, and I was still push starting the same car that I got sober in, 68 Volkswagen, hole in the floorboard, had to push start the thing, and everything I owned was in that Volkswagen, puttering up the LA freeways to go to Covina, didn't even know where Covina was, and I'm starting to think, I need a life. I really need a life. I've heard people talk about having a life in AA. I need one of those. I'm going to go to school, I'm going to work, I'm going to be real busy. I need to get a life. I'm behind. Got to get a life. Be busy. I'll stop by a meeting once in a while if I need one, but, you know, and I'll go and I'll see where the meeting hall is, but I'm going to be busy. Going to go to school. I'm going to work. When I get a life, I'll get more active, but 2 years sober, about ready to make a fatal decision. Decided to find out where the little AA clubhouse was in Covina, and I pulled in, and man, I was discouraged right off the bat. The parking lot's flat. One of the tools for living when you're push-starting cars is you're looking for a little bit of an incline, just a little bit of an incline. I go into this noon meeting, and the man making coffee that day came over to me. His name was Eddie Cochran. He had this medallion. It said 1951. I know what that meant. That meant he was 10 years sober when I was born. And he came over and he said the very same thing that that guy said to me when I was fresh out of treatment. He said, never seen you here before. What are you doing? Oh, I had a much better story this time. I said, sir, very nice to see your meeting hall here. I'm 2 years sober, fresh out of the United States Navy. I'm going to be real busy. You won't see me very often. I'm going to be going to school. I'm going to be working. Got to get a life. And Eddie, just the way he always did, he just chuckled. He said, oh, son, school and work, that's wonderful, but that's what we do in between meetings. What he was giving me is one of the secrets to long-term sobriety comfortably, and what he was really telling me is that I need to live in Alcoholics Anonymous and visit the world instead of trying to hash it out there in the world and visiting Alcoholics Anonymous when convenient. First thing he told me that I needed to do was put new guys in my car. I said, well, I've got to push start the thing. There's a hole in the floorboard. He said, put new guys in your car, your life will get better. I didn't see how that could possibly be, but I remembered he was 10 years sober when I was born, so I thought I'd give it a shot. And the very first night that I did that, I realized he had not lied to me. The very first night, my life got better. After the meeting, looked over my shoulder, and by God, my life was better. The new guys were push starting my car for me. He didn't say how much better, he just said better. I got to tell you, the 28 years that I've been here, I found a life that I did not even know existed. Didn't even know it existed. I can sum it all up by telling this little story. 1998, I was asked to come and do what I'm doing right now, down in Nogales, Arizona. It's back when everybody used to carry pagers. Remember those pagers? And before I left, and you're supposed to have nationwide coverage, but there's big, giant blackout areas in the country. So before I left, I called my mom. And I said, Mom, if you page me this weekend and I don't answer, I don't want you to worry. I'm going to be in Nogales, Arizona, and the pager might not work. She goes, oh, Nogales, oh, you got to get a hold of Don and Leona. They would love to hear from you. And I had to say, Mom, remind me, who's Don and Leona? She goes, oh, that's right. You haven't seen them since you were like 9 years old. But Don and Leona, lifelong friends. Don was the best man at your father's and my wedding. You got to give him a call. He'd love to hear from you. So I said, give me the number. I called up Don. And I said, Don, it's Carl Morris. He goes, oh, Carl, good to hear from you. He said, I'm going to be down in Nogales. I think I'm just 20 miles south, maybe 30 miles south of where you are. Love to maybe come up for lunch. He goes, oh, no, you bring your golf clubs. I know you love to golf. It was weird. How do you know that? It's true. I'm a golf whore. I'll golf with anybody at any time for any reason. Really, I don't even need to know your name. Right? I'll golf with you. Just ask Jamie. I'm going to golf with anybody. All right. So I took my clubs, and on Saturday morning, I left the conference, and I drove up to meet him at his golf course, and we started to walk along. And as we walked along, I got really confused because he started to ask me very specific, pertinent questions about my life. And, you know, he knew what school I had graduated from, what my degree was in, what companies I was with, the recovery homes. You know, he just knew everything about my life. And by the fourth hole, I go, Don, I'm just really confused. I barely got a couple of questions in to find out, you know, what you retired from, but you seem to know all about my life. How is that? I haven't seen you since I've been 9 years old. He goes, oh, that's easy. So easy, Carl. Before your father passed away a couple of years ago, you couldn't shut him up. He would just go on and on. It was like a little irritating, Carl. He would go on and on about you. Now, that was nice to hear, but it wasn't news. It wasn't news. Because I had taken the actions you guys told me to right off the bat when I first got sober, and that was quit trying to be understood by your father and learn how to understand him. It was so vitally important for me to learn that. That because of that, because you guys gave me the direction, when my father passed away, he and I were good. We were good friends. There was nothing unsaid. See, if I would have procrastinated and maybe stayed in that idea of he doesn't even understand me sober, if I would have stayed in that frame of mind and missed it, I believe, in my case, I don't know about yours, but in my case, I would have lived the rest of my life as half a man without really knowing who my father was. So it was nice to hear, but it wasn't news. The next thing that he said, I couldn't even swing the club anymore. He said, and other than your father always talking about you, every Christmas your mother writes that Christmas letter. I'm like, yes! Finally I got in that damn thing. I'm gonna close it with this. 17 years sober, I got married. Didn't work. I know you've never heard about that in AA. But we had these two beautiful kids. They are 8 years old and 10 years old right now, Madison and Ryan. And although the marriage didn't work, we figured out a way to be good co-parents. She is a very good mother. And she and I, it was hard, but we have negotiated a way to be good co-parents. And I got to tell you, I have never loved somebody. I didn't know love was like that. It's like I met who I would die for. I know that when I raised my hand in the military that I said I would, but I was hoping it was not going to come to that, you know, that I'd die for you. You know, and I love a lot of people. My friend Ralph is right here. He's speaking Sunday morning. Do not miss him. But I love Ralph. He and I travel the country together quite often. I love him. But I got to tell you, if he and I are out at Starbucks later and, you know, guy comes in with a gun and says, it's going to be one of you, I'd say, have you met my friend Ralph? But if it was my kids, that wouldn't even be a question. I didn't even know I could love another human being this way. And I love them at the depths of my soul. And I would never trade them for the first drink. Never in a million years would I trade my kids for the first drink. But I'm alcoholic. I know what it means to be alcoholic. Although I would never trade them for the first drink, I would trade them for the second drink like that. So there is nothing that's more important than me staying in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm so glad that there are thousands, if not millions, right here in Southern California that feel the same way about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I get to stand shoulder to shoulder with you in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we all get to save our lives. Have a great weekend.
We hope you have enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.